From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's the middle voice, butt of jokes, but always there, the viola. Too small to boom like a cello, too ungainly to soar like a violin. But right there in the middle of the string quartet, and there 1,000 years ago as the big medieval fiddle, there Baroque as the viola d'amore. Garth Knox is master and champion of the viola. He's with us with music and history today. This hour On Point, the middle voice, the viola. You can join the conversation. Viola people, speak now for your instrument. What is the song of the viola? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Paris is prize-winning violist and composer Garth Knox. Former member of the acclaimed Arditti String Quartet, he's performed and premiered works from John Cage, Morton Feldman, George Ligeti, and other guests, other greats. He looks back through nearly 1,000 years of viola music on his latest album, Saltarello. Garth Knox, in Paris, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
That's Saltarello behind us right now. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, this is an album, as you say, which goes through 1,000 years of string music. And I think on the viola, we're well placed for it because, first, I'd like to point out the word viola is actually in Italian the generic term for all the string instruments. And violin, violino, means small viola. So rather than thinking of the violin as a big violin, you can think of the violin as a small viola.
Indeed, you might. But we know that there is a vast repertoire of viola jokes out there that go the other way. You know, here's just a few we picked up today. How do you keep your violin from getting stolen? Put it in a viola case. What's the difference between a violin and a viola? One, the viola burns longer. Two, the viola holds more beer. Three, you can tune the violin. What's the difference between a viola and a trampoline? You take your shoes off to jump on a trampoline. What is with this anti-viola school of jokes? What's up with that?
I love the viola jokes. They make me laugh so much. You know, everyone has to laugh at somebody. It makes us all feel better. And we laugh at ourselves on the viola. You know, I think it's funny too. So why not?
But what's the origin? I mean, is it this generic thing sort of between the violin and the cello just droning on, filling in the middle space?
Yeah, well, it used to be there weren't any specialists. The only people who played violin would pick up the viola. And, of course, the good people would stay on the top line and the less good people would fill in the middle line because the middle line is much less important, or it was much less important in the classical times. The top and the bottom were the important things. But, of course, if you want to hear well, that's the best place to be. You're sitting in the middle. And many composers play the viola just for that reason, and sat in the middle of the string quartet, the middle of the orchestra. Then you can really hear what's going on. You're in the engine room when you're playing the viola. And it gives you a great advantage to know what's happening.
Describe physically for us the viola, just so people who are not musicians, not string musicians, know exactly what you're talking about. Okay, on here, one side is the violin, on the other side is the cello, you know, standing on the floor. The viola, how do you play it? What's it look like? What's the size?
Well, it's quite similar to the violin. Seen from afar, you wouldn't notice a big difference. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit bigger, but it has a deeper string on the bottom and it doesn't have the top string. So the voice is already pitched a bit little more like the human voice than the violin is, which is already a little bit high. Mm-hmm. It actually has the same strings as the cello, but an octave higher. And as you said, its role is to fill in that middle ground between the bottom and the top.
An inch, two, three, four longer than the violin, depending on its size.
That's right, yes. There isn't a standard model of the viola. There's all different shapes and sizes, and people are still experimenting with them, which is exactly what I did. And what's nice about the viola, too, is the repertoire we have in the mainstream repertoire, a solo repertoire, is quite small. So you can get around it quite quickly, and then if you're curious like I am, you start exploring things before and after the standard repertoire.
So you're playing this under your fiddle. It's like a big violin.
It's like a big violin. You play it under the chin, just like a violin. That's right.
Under your chin.
But because it's a little bit bigger, it's a little bit slower. So that's probably where the jokes come from. You can't play quite as fast as on the violin.
Because your fingers are spread out over
your fingers
a longer
are
neck.
Farther apart. That's right. The strings are bigger and heavier. The string resists a bit more. But people who play the viola get very interested in the sound, whereas in the violin you're interested in playing the notes. In the viola you think about playing just one or two notes and making them sound really good.
We've got all kinds of jokes on that front. How can you tell when a violist is playing out of tune? The bow is moving. Right. How is lightning like a violist's fingers? Neither one strikes in the same place twice. Why do violists stand for long periods outside people's houses? They can't find the key and they don't know when to come in.
I'm sorry for all those, but
I love it.
But it's slower because you just can't do that kind of Paganini rip at light speed.
That's right. It just speaks that little bit slower, but that gives you more time to think. You see, you can play. You can play as fast, but you can think much faster. And as I say, exploring the outside has always appealed to me. You know, when I was at school, music was taught like it began with Bach and finished with Brahms. Mm. And, you know, like there was before Bach, there was some kind of primeval slime out of which Bach climbed and made the first notes. And when Brahms died, the slime took over again. Only a few madmen were left who wrote all the wrong notes. And this to me seemed like an unlikely explanation of musical history. Mm. And so as soon as I had the chance, I started looking outside those lines and found some wonderful music.
Well, take us way back. You've got nearly 1,000 years covered here. We can go back 900 years.
The furthest we could go was the 12th century, I think. There's music by Hildegard von Bingen, who was a wonderful woman who lived a long time ago, and for a long, long time, a visionary who had visions. She heard music, she saw, and she made beautiful paintings, and she wrote music, and she lived a very long time. And it's a large collection of her music, which is kind of Gregorian chant, like you would sing in a church, but very extravagant, a huge range, almost too big for the voice, and very tempting for an instrumentalist.
You've got a bit of it on your album, Saltarello. Now, this is played on a traditional medieval fiddle, I guess the forebear to the modern viola.
That's right. When you look at medieval paintings, Renaissance paintings also, you see angels playing these instruments, which look like kind of primitive violins. You know, violins had this kind of feminine shape with a very thin waist and the big hips. Mm-hmm. Well, the viols were just starting to do that. They were quite basic. There's two pieces of wood, the back and the front. You stick them together, put some strings on, and you're off. Usually 5 strings, flat bridge, so you can play all the strings all the time. And it's really a dance instrument, or for accompanying the voice, a poetry or a singing voice. And it's very agreeable to play. It's made to the shape of the body. It fits snugly into your hand. You don't have to think how to hold it. You hold it down by your side, not really under the chin at all.
We'll get to that. Let's take a little time travel. You make it possible for us. This is Hildegard von Bingen, of all things, 900 years ago. Ave Generosa on the traditional medieval fiddle, forebear of the viola. Garth, that is well and truly beautiful. We can hear that Gregorian chant kind of sound you mentioned, and the sort of praise sound of this mystic visionary Hildegard von Bingen writing 900 years ago. Would it have sound like that in her German abbey then?
It's hard to say. I mean, obviously it would have been sung, but as I say, the register is so big, it's hard to believe they didn't accompany it with instruments, and probably there'd be a droning instrument anyway going on, as you can hear. And the medieval fiddle is made for droning, because there are all these strings. As I say, there are 5 strings. Mm. I have it here on my lap, actually, and it's hard to resist playing it, because it's such a nice sound. Mm. And it has this very rustic sound. There's something very earthy about it. You can hear the wood, you know, it's a very wooden sound. In fact, there are 3 sounds. There's the sound of the wood, there's the sound of the gut, which the strings are made of, and there's the sound of the horsehair of the bow. I use very rough horsehair.
Thicker horsehair than a violin.
It's a Mongolian sound, isn't it?
Yes, it does. I'm right there with the Tuvan throat singers, and off we go.
Absolutely. Well, that's where the bow came from, and that, you know, they're the first sounds we made when it came were those sounds.
And do you literally use a coarser, thicker horsehair for the viola?
I do. I ask for especially coarse horsehair on it. I do, so you can get that very, very, you know, earthy, rustic sound, which I like so much.
Gosh, take off some more with that. Do give us anything. This is the precursor. Is that the flat neck that I'm reading about here, or is it the curved neck where you can bow over to get the different individual strings?
You can get the top string and the bottom string. The middle ones you can with a bit of practice, but it's really made for having at least 2 strings going all the time. And the neck is very thick, so it's very, as I say, it's the shape of your hand. It just fits snugly into your hand, lies down your arm. And the first viols were actually called viola da braccio, which means the arm viola, because you play it in your arm.
Is it meant to be a drone kind of then sound?
Absolutely, yes. The drone was the heart of the matter. I mean, it's a very good basis for anything. So all the notes were in a reference to the drone. And even this music by Hildegard von Bingen, it's all in reference to one note. So the drone is, I think, is a very natural. That's how we started making music.
Let us hear that drony sound.
Very good for Celtic music.
Gosh, great.
Almost a bagpipe, isn't it?
Yes, almost a bagpipe. You're right there. And the sort of constant sound with that flat neck that takes us, well, you can travel on that. Never mind time travel. It's just kind of a prompt to imagination, to set yourself a little free in the mystic there.
Yeah, well, it sets my alter ego free. My mystic, rustic, rough side comes out in this. You make a joke about this, and I'll come and play with this thing right in your ear.
Hey, Garth, stand by there in Paris. Garth Knox is with us, great violist and composer. His collected works, most recently Saltarello. This is pipe, harp, and fiddle, arranged for medieval fiddle and percussion off the album. Garth will be right back with much more of the viola. Listeners, you can join us. Do you know it? Do you play it? Do you search it out? Who plays the viola? And what's the song of the middle voice here? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We are time traveling with the viola. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the music and history, medieval to modern, of the viola. Bigger than a violin, smaller than a cello, we're looking at 1,000 years of the middle voice instrument of the string family. Garth Knox is with us, prize-winning violist and composer, also plays the viola d'amore, which we hear behind us right now, and medieval fiddle. His new collection of works is Saltarello. You can hear and see him perform his music at our website, onpointradio.org. Joins us today from Paris with instruments in the studio, including the viola. Do you know it? Play it. Search it out. Who chooses to play the viola? What is the song of the middle voice here? Is this the forgotten sister, brother? Music teachers, who do you hand a viola? Who makes the perfect player? Violinist, cellist, tell the truth. What do you make of the viola? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And Garth, I promise I will stop with this soon, but these viola jokes are just too good. The music is contradicting them track by track, but here's, what is the range of a viola? As far as you can kick it. What do you call a bunch of violists in a hot tub? Vegetable soup. What do the violists marry the accordion player? Upward mobility. But behind us right here, right now, the Henry Purcell's music for a while belies all that. I mean, this is beautiful. Tell us about this, the Viola d'amore.
This is great. The Viola d'amore, the viola of love, it would be in English, is a very refined instrument, as opposed to the medieval fiddle, which is quite rough and rustic. This is all in Baroque refinement. Mm. It has many, many strings. It comes really from the viola da gamba. Anyway, if you know the viola da gamba. Mm-hmm. And actually, there are two families in the violin family. There's a violin family and there's a gamba family. Basically, one you play under the chin like a violin, and the other is played in the position like the cello. Gamba means leg. So there's the leg viola and there's the arm viola. And the viola d'amore is bringing together these two families, because it's actually a small viola da gamba, but you play it under the chin, on the heart, as the viola of love would like to be played.
So here's an English composer, though, with this Italian-sounding instrument. This is 1692, accompanied here by cellist Agnes Vesterman, and you on the viola d'amore.
Yes.
So English, Italian, kind of intertwining here as Europe got to know itself?
There's an intertwining here, yes. Actually, Purcell didn't originally write this for viola d'amore. That was my idea.
It's for
voice and accompaniment, but it fits so well, and it's a song all about love, and it seemed to me perfect. And the viola d'amore has a great capacity for harmony. It's not just a melody instrument. That's the big difference. It had many strings. It actually has 14 strings, which is quite a lot, especially for a viola player to handle. Luckily, seven of them you don't have to play at all. They go down the back of the instrument and they just vibrate in resonance, like resonance strings. So they're singing in the background and you play the ones in front.
We've got lots of response online. Okay, sorry, I can't. We've got one more. Anne says, how can you tell if the stage is level if the violist is drooling out of both sides of his mouth or her mouth? Sorry. But we've got plenty who love it here. Jason says, I always found the viola to be more melodic and listenable than the violin, which is like the electric guitar of the orchestra for some reason. And here's Will Roselip. Oh, our friend Will Roselip writes to us on Facebook. Viola, the secret leader of the orchestra. What cellists, and he's a cellist, don't want to admit is that some cello repertoire sounds better on the viola. Having just admitted that, he writes on Facebook, I feel better about myself. You grew up with brothers and sisters playing viola and cello and violin around you on the viola.
I was born into the viola seat in the quartet because my two sisters played the violin, my brother played cello when I was born. So all the good instruments were gone. There was only left the viola.
I think we're hearing just the opposite of that today. Let's hear a little more, something much more contemporary. We're going to bounce back and forth in time here. That was 1692. Here's something of yours from 2009. This is Viola Spaces, Movement 4, Rapid Retreat. Let's listen. There to get a much, it's not a violin sound, but you got a lot more frenetic sound there than our medieval forebears.
You certainly do. There's a lot of middle in the viola. It's very nice. That's, as I was saying, Ella, it's a bit where the human voice is placed. So you feel like you're speaking a little more than the violin does.
Gosh, that's
maybe trying to make sense.
Yeah, maybe. Amanda, Cromwell, Connecticut is calling. Amanda, thanks. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my time call. I am so excited that you have this topic today.
Great. Do you play?
Not as much as I do anymore, but when I was younger, I played a lot.
And what do you make of the viola? We've heard all the wisecracks here. What drew you to it, Amanda?
You know, the music program started in my elementary school. So at the age of 9, I was allowed to choose a string instrument to play. Mm-hmm. And I purposely chose the viola because everybody else I knew was choosing the violin or the cello. I wanted something different, and it was the best decision I could have ever made.
And why? What is it about the viola that makes you stand so tall for it?
I think it provided the rich, robust tones of the cello, but still provided the sweet sounds of the violin as well. It was the perfect mix as far as I was concerned.
Rich and robust and sweet all at the same time, says Amanda. Let's hear that a little here from Vivaldi. Here we go back to 18th century. Concerto for Viola d'Amore in D minor. Beautiful, and Vivaldi for sure. John in Nashville, thank you for calling, John. You're on the air.
Tom, hi. What a wonderful show.
Oh, good.
I think you're overlooking one of my favorite viola jokes.
Okay.
The difference in an onion and a viola.
Between an onion? Did you say an onion and the viola? Okay, yes.
Yes. No one ever cries when you slice up the viola.
Why are they so hard, John?
I just love the jokes because viola draws derision because it's less agile, and I think we're outnumbered because as a youngster they're very ungainly to hold.
Yes, a little longer than that violin, yeah.
As I get on in my 60s, I'm finding arthritis to be a bit of an issue because you have to decide how to warm up and prepare to play the instrument and to become agile. But I'm thrilled with the instrument. I played violin all my life. and in grad school was encouraged to turn to it because there were so few violists. But there's just a warmth and a resonance in those notes that it sustains, and that's what's satisfying to me about it.
You think, what does it give it, that resonance, some authority there, John?
Well, the size of the instrument, it's just a little bit larger, and the string slightly larger. It's just designed physically to be a more resonant instrument.
So what's your metaphor, your comparison, viola versus violin?
Well, there are many. One I just happened to think of is maybe the difference in a luxury car and a two-seater sports car, where you sacrifice agility, but you gain comfort and resonance. And I just find the way that it feels under my chin very satisfying.
Talk about authority. John, you really speak with that authority of a lifetime player there. Garth, what do you say to your fellow appreciator of the viola there in Nashville?
I think it's really encouraging. You know, when you meet viola players, we always feel a sort of sympathy with each other, a sympathy and an empathy. And we all have this love of the sound. As I was saying before, it's a really important thing to us how one note sounds. We're not so concerned about playing 1,000 notes, but just finding the right one, you know, still looking for it in there somewhere.
Mm. Martha in Mattapan, Massachusetts. John in Nashville, thanks. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, yes.
I'm coming to the viola actually from a vocalist perspective. I'm a vocalist, and I'm actually a mezzo-soprano.
Okay.
So I have very sympathetic feelings to the viola there.
I've
always known about the viola,
mm-hmm.
and known about the orchestra, and I've sung in choruses with the orchestra, but I didn't really get to know or hear the viola as well until we sang The Damnation of Faust.
Ooh.
And the viola
Berlioz.
Was used to, yes, by Berlioz, and the viola was used to introduce one of the characters, and I noticed the beauty of it right then and there, and just got really sympathetic with it and realized how Berlioz writes very nicely for the medium voices, not only for the viola, but for the mezzo-soprano as well, and also got introduced to Harold in Italy by Berlioz, which is basically a duet for viola and orchestra, and came to realize the beauty of the viola.
There's the mezzo-soprano standing up for the middle voice of the viola. I love it, Martha. That's just fantastic. Thank you so much for that. Garth Knox in Paris, I mean, here's The Damnation of Faust, Berlioz, and he chooses viola to bring it in. Why do you imagine? Why would you reach for that if you're Berlioz?
So nice. Well, I think he understood a bit of the nature of the instrument. Instead of doing a really flashy concerto where the instrument is up front and dominating, he tells a story with it. It gives the viola a very simple tune to play and illustrates it with winding the orchestra all around about it. I think Paganini, I believe, who it was written for, refused to play it, saying there weren't enough notes or something. Hard enough.
Of course, Paganini, it's got to be stuffed.
That's right. He has to play all the time from beginning to end.
Right.
But this is a very beautiful piece by Berlioz, which tells a story and uses the color of the viola to add something special to the music.
Martha, you're a good co-religionist of the mezzo range there. Thank you for calling. Jim in South Royalton, Vermont. Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Yes.
This is great. I love the viola. I'm not as much of a classical fan. I like it. However, I'm more into Cajun and bluegrass and Celtic music, and I heard your guest mention something about the viola in some Celtic pieces. What I'm kind of wondering is, like, is there any, like, recommendation or whatever on where I'd look in those genres for people who play the viola?
We will get that advice for you, Jim, and let's do it. Let's go straight there. We've got a little something you may enjoy then. I mean, this is Black Brittany. This is the old traditional Irish air, Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair, combined with the 20th century piece Leaving Brittany. That's fiddler Johnny Cunningham. And Garth Knox weaves this is the viola d'amour seamlessly into that sort of sweet, sorrowful texture of what he then calls Black Brittany. Thank you. Garth Knox's arrangement of Black Brittany. Caller Jim, we're leaning, trying to lean toward you there, but Garth, talk to us about the sort of folk legacy, history of the viola, and what about our callers specifically yearning there for a little viola in Cajun or country or you name it?
It's true, you don't hear it so much. Some people are starting to do it now. In a way, it's a little more difficult because the register doesn't cut through as much as a violin does for the dance numbers. But the viola d'amore, on the other hand, has this top string which is almost as high as a violin's. And I sort of found it by accident. I was playing, you know, baroque music on the viola d'amore, and suddenly I started fooling around and playing some of the old Irish tunes. I mean, I was born in Dublin and feel very Irish and Scottish. And it came out so well because you can do, you know, you can do the fiddle stuff. You can also do the bagpipe stuff a little bit in a kind of refined way. And this Black Brittany, it's almost like baroque music. The folk music sounds so beautiful on the viola d'amore with all the resonance strings and all this kind of thing. I think it's maybe a coming new thing. I'm going to explore it a lot more.
When did things tip from this viola d'amore, or d'amore as some say, to the modern shape of the viola as we know it, Garth?
Well, the viola d'amore was a kind of sideline, and it kind of came to a stop because it was great in one key. And music at that time was in one key. But then as composers were going to want to change key, you know, start in one key and finish the piece in another, the viola d'amore with its seven strings being tuned to open tuning like in one key just couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And it got washed up a side water. I think, you know, that it was a baby that got thrown out with the bathwater. And I think it had a lot more to offer before it disappeared. So I'm bringing it back now, and I'm not the only one. I think it's coming back into fashion.
So in the string quartet, let's say you're playing with your sisters and brother.
Right.
Describe you've got normally, what, two violins, viola, cello?
Normally it's two violins, viola, cello. And the cello has the bass, the first violin has the tune, and the second violin and the viola are very much together in the engine room. They're making the harmony.
And this,
when we started out, I was the worst. I was the youngest by far. So the others were very good. And every year we used to play the Eine kleine Nacht of Mozart for Christmas. Mm. And every year they got worse, and every year I got better. And by the end, it was torture for me. But good training.
What torture for you in what sense? Playing with your siblings?
Well, it got harder and harder to recognize the tune, you know. They only practice once a year at Christmas. They played for fun. I mean, I play for fun too. But as I got better, they got worse.
Yeah. William in Stowe, Massachusetts. William, you're on the air. Hello, William. You're on, my friend.
Thank you so much for taking the call. I've got a particular question. Last year I went to a Handel and Haydn Society concert and heard a very distinguished gentleman who also conducted, and I'm not going to be able to recall his name, very distinguished man who played baroque viola, and he was obviously so accomplished, and he obviously had his hands so completely full with the challenges of that instrument. I'm wondering what is so particularly challenging about playing the baroque viola compared to the contemporary viola.
Garth Knox.
Well, maybe it's part of holding it. The idea is you hold the baroque viola with your arm and your body, and it can be a little more complicated until you get used to it a little. And also, the gestures are kind of bigger. You join in, you breathe, and you move around a bit more. So maybe this was getting in the way of his conducting. I don't know. Some people find it easy, some people find it difficult.
With the body, meaning, as you said, up against sort of your heart instead of your neck, or...
That's right, yes, and it's kind of a physical thing. The bowing as well, you join in more with the whole body when you play the baroque style. It's not just isolated the arm movement, it's the whole body that plays.
And if you were to play, I don't know, a long concert, which is more taxing, the viola up under your chin or the viola d'amore up against your chest?
It's a different kind of thing. I think it's more relaxing to have it away from your chin. I think, you know, your head is made for thinking and maybe for speaking or singing. The head's not just a dead weight to hold the instrument with. I think it's a bit of a waste of resources. So the baroque thing seems to me less tiring, but people are different, you know. Some people find them more tiring.
Garth Knox is with us, joins us from Paris, instruments in hand, and we'll come to them. We're talking about the music and history, medieval to modern, of the viola. You can join the conversation this hour. You know, violinist, cellist, tell the truth. What do you make of the viola? What would the string quartet be without it? We'll go out here with Flow My Tears. This is John Dolan, 16th century, 1596 to be precise. Standard piece from the time of Shakespeare. Enjoy it. We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Thank you. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour and really enjoying the music and history, medieval to modern, of the viola. Bigger than a violin, smaller than a cello. We're looking at 1,000 years of the middle voice of the string family. Garth Knox joins us from Paris, terrific violist and composer. Also plays the medieval fiddle in the Viola d'Amore. We've heard a good bit of that. His latest collection of works is Saltarello. Behind us here right now is an earlier work of his, Viola Spaces No. 8, Up, Down, Sideways, Round, from his 2009 album, Viola Spaces. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you hear in the deep history, the deep sound of the viola? What do we learn when we pull bow this string of musical history? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Garth Knox there in Paris. You're definitely getting, again, a lot more, speed, pacing, kind of a tempo range here than we hear in that earlier work, Garth, in your 2009 work.
Well, I think there's a lot to be got out of the viola, and these are little pieces which I wrote for fun, basically, because I think one difference between the violin and the viola, I think we have more fun on the viola. We don't take ourselves so seriously, which is very nice.
That's good and lucky. We started with a blast of viola jokes, but this instrument is fully redeeming itself. We hear it, and it's wonderful. Rachel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Rachel, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Garth Knox.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to kind of give a shout-out to all my fellow violists. I am a violist in the Boston area, and I play in two really weird rock bands that both have viola. We play all over Boston and the East Coast. And actually, just kind of what you were just talking about the quirky personality that makes up a viola player. Because we're not the egocentric violinist. Like, we're the sense of humor. We're the depth in the string quartet. Like, we do have that personality.
Hey, you know, Rachel, rock bands with viola are rare enough. We want to know the names of your two rock bands.
Absolutely. I play in a band called Jaggery, which also has an orchestral harp and amazing vocals. And I also play in a crazy, raucous, circusy mess called Walter Sickert and the Army of Broken Toys.
We love it. We will listen for them, and we appreciate your good-humored viola nature. Thank you so much, Rachel. Hey, let's get something really contemporary while we contemplate Rachel's rock bands here. Maybe you'll introduce it for us, Garth. This is Vo Nocturne. This is Kaija Saariaho.
Kaija Saariaho, that's right. She's a Finnish composer who's actually in New York this year for a year writing an opera for the Met. And she explored a very beautiful part of the viola, which is making wind noises with a viola.
How do you do that?
Well, you can either do it if you're very good or if you're very bad. They both work. What it means is you don't play exactly on the string. They both are grazes against the bridge or the side of the viola, like where you're not supposed to play. And out comes this windy sound. Beautiful. Sounds like someone breathing.
It's kind of unnerving. I was listening last night. I mean, this is sort of, you don't know what's going on. It's really, let's listen a little. This is Vo Nocturne from Kaija Saariaho. Nearly the sound of wind blowing there, the breaths of the obscure, the movement here. And really that sound almost of wind in the background is just sort of edging along the string, Garth?
It is, yes. Kaija is, this is a piece we kind of made in her kitchen at home. She has an electronic studio at home.
She wrote it for you, really.
She wrote it for me, yes, yeah. Yes. She's underlining with the electronics what's already there. So I'm making this wind noise on the viola, and she's using electronics to underline that and bring in some drone noises, maybe going back to the medieval type sound, and mixing it into a night wind. And in front of this electronic wind sound, the viola sort of crosses an Arctic landscape all alone, going higher and lower and lower and lower as the piece goes on. It's a beautiful piece.
Really something. Is she a mystic like Hildegard von Bingen here, an Arctic mystic,
well,
your Finn?
I was glad to get her on the same album as Hildegard von Bingen, you know, the lady from the 21st century. She's doing something almost as moving as Hildegard von Bingen. She's from Finland, so she's ice and fire altogether, you know. When you're talking to her, she seems quite cold. Underneath, you can feel the volcano that's burning there. Fascinating person.
Terrific. Let's go north, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Erica's calling. Hi, Erica, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a particular comment or question for Mr. Knox. If you could discuss some artists like Nadia Sirota out of New York.
who Nico Muli calls his muse, and she said viola in one of her articles, I believe, called viola the most indie instrument because of its match with vocals and register. And also I'm wondering if he could talk a little bit about the kind of how viola works in rock music and pop music and Indian hip-hop today.
Do you play, Erica, may I ask?
I do, yes. I do a lot of recording and performing in Minneapolis.
With a symphony there or a string quartet?
No, I do rock, indie rock, and hip-hop in town.
Oh, I love it. Fantastic. Garth, yeah. what do you say? Nadia Sirota, the most indie instrument here.
Yeah, great. Well, I think in a way it's not really surprising that people are experimenting with the viola, because if you play the violin, there's so many other people have done so much before you. You're always worried about the tradition of what other people have done. On the viola, there's so much, you know, virgin territory out there. If you're starting out into rock, you're one of the few violists who do rock. You can go into indie, and it's a new sound. People are used to the violin sound. They're not so used to the viola sound. And so you're already being more original. It pushes you to be creative to play the viola, I think.
Oh, Erica, very happy to hear from you from Minneapolis. And her particular interest in Nadia there, do you know Nadia Sirota, Garth?
I'm afraid I don't know Nadia Sirota. I'd be interested to know her.
Well, we'll keep our eyes out. Let's get another Erica here. Thank you, Minneapolis Erica. Boston Erica, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I was just calling because I had I'm a non-professional player, but I grew up playing the violin, and one of the things I enjoyed most when I sort of made the switch over to viola was the fact that it allowed me to access music that was designed for other instruments that just don't fit on the violin. And I'm thinking particularly of the Bach cello suites, which I just think are some of the most moving and beautiful
mm-hmm.
pieces of music to play and to listen to. And they've transposed them for all sorts of different instruments, and you play it on the violin and it just sounds whiny and not at all appropriate. But when you play it on the viola, you know, given that it's an octave above where it was originally intended to be,
mm-hmm.
But it still has that warmth and that depth. And I would have never gotten a chance to put my own spin on those pieces of music if I hadn't made the switch over. So I just think for those of us who are not professionals but still enjoy and love music that are originally written for other instruments, it's such a wonderful sort of transition or access point.
Hey, Eric, we'll put that to Garth Knox, but tell us first, so you play the viola non-professionally. Describe for us how you came to do that.
Well, I started playing violin when I was really young and enjoyed it a lot. And when I got into high school, we had like 80,000 and there was one violist. And so I pretty much said, well, you know, I don't really want to sit in, you know, as a ninth grader, I didn't want to sit in the back of the second violin with 15 million other students in front of me. And so I switched over to use some of the skills that I had and got to challenge myself in a different way. And really found a lot of
and it's still with you. Oh, you're breaking up and I'm sorry for it, but we'll picture you just enjoying it because you've got it and you can. Garth Knox, what about this middle voice and its ability to reach down and grab those Bach cello suites, for example, in a way the violin
That's
has
right.
a much
Erica
harder time doing?
Erica brings up a very good point there. The repertoire just open to us is really immense. And actually, Bach is a very good case in point because there are these beautiful cello pieces which you can play. And we can also play the beautiful violin pieces that Bach wrote. So we have a huge repertoire for Bach because either the violin or the cello, we have the double,
mm-hmm.
which we can do.
That middle position has its advantages, after all. Let's go to Dwight in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Dwight, you're on the air with Garth Knox.
Hi, Garth. Hi, Tom. Oh. I just wanted to say I've always heard regarding the Viola d'Amore that it was not the viola of love, but the viola of the Moors, that the Viola d'Amore is really a corruption, that it is a Viola d'Amore. Therefore, the scimitars on the instrument, or the F-holes, are shaped like scimitars, and it has a very Eastern sound to it.
Wow. Garth, I must in fairness convey to you that I see here that Dwight is no less than the historian for the American Viola Society. So how about it?
He's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. And there's no it came through the Arabs, the Viola d'Amore. And it could well be a very authentic theory. And in Italian, it's difficult to say. It's Viola d'Amore or Viola d'Amore, which sounds the same to me. So it could easily be. And the sympathetic strings are a very sort of Arab-sounding thing. But the bow, you know, came to us through the Arabs too, from Mongolia in the 9th century. The Arabs brought us this. So it's, in a way, it's a very one part of the fertile mix in Europe that happened in Spain between the Moors and the Spanish. It's our heritage as well in the Viola d'Amore.
Dwight, in Bowling Green, you're there with the American Viola Society, no less. What's your sense of the vigor of the American viola community these days?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask that because we just completed the 40th annual International Viola Congress at Rochester, New York. We had over 500 people signed up, and we had a variety of styles, from Baroque viola to Baroque, classical, contemporary. But one of the most interesting things that I heard was some jazz and Louisiana, Appalachian influence from a composer-performer named Kenji Bunch. And so this is an individual take on the viola that would fit right in with Garth's style and that of others that you've discussed on the program.
Oh, that's just terrific. 500 violists in Rochester and Kenji Bunch among them. Dwight, thank you very much for your thread out to maybe to the Moorish origin of the word there. Thanks for your call from Bowling Green. Let's get one from Melrose, Massachusetts. Anai, you're on the air with Garth Knox in Paris. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. How are you? And hello, Mr. Knox.
Hi.
I'm calling to say that I'm the proud mama of a child who is a second-year viola student, and she chose the viola last year when she was 8, precisely because of its sound. My sneaking suspicion is because it's in the same register as my voice, more or less. And but she just loves her viola, and I don't think she would have stuck with it had she chosen the violin or the cello, quite frankly. And the second piece I'd like to say is to ask Mr. Knox what he thinks of the transcription of Winterreise. That is my all-time favorite piece of music.
Schubert.
Ever. And then Hartmut Kohl has done a viola transcription, which I think is now out of print, unfortunately. But I've given it to as many people as I could over the years.
Great. Our time is short. Let me put it to him, if I may. Anai, the viola-voiced Anai. Schubert's Winterreise, do you know that transposing?
Absolutely, yes. It works very, very successfully. Yes, in fact, Schubert's songs work very well for viola, even without the words. And it's a bit as what we were saying earlier. It corresponds to a human voice. Mm. And if you play it well, you have the impression it means something. So I think using these vocal songs on the viola is a very good idea. The Winterreise is, of course, the most magnificent music there is, or among the most magnificent music. So I think I encourage everyone to go out and play it and listen to it.
Let's hear a little bit more of what Garth Knox himself has done. This is Fuga Libre. This is for viola solo, 2009. Pushing the limits of what a viola can do and at the same time kind of looking back at its folk roots. Right out on the edge there with Garth Knox on his viola. That is just wonderful. Brittany in Lynn, Massachusetts. Brittany, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question has to do with my middle school students. I'm an orchestra teacher, actually, out here in the Lynn Public Schools.
Great.
And I try to get so many of my violinists to switch to viola because we always need viola. And then they get to middle school and they realize that they have to shift and they're just terrified of it. I personally think it is harder to shift and get into the higher registers on the viola than it is on the violin. So what do you recommend for young students in shifting?
Shifting, you mean moving the hand up the neck? Is that what that's about, Brittany?
Yes.
Oh, Garth, over to you.
Sure. Yeah, I think you just have to be brave. It's one thing, or else don't just stay in the first position. First position is what you learn first. Then you gradually slide up the string. But the thing we just heard actually is a good example. I like to slide around all over the string, and it gives you a feeling, a contact with the string, which afterwards gives you confidence, so you find the right note. Because part of the difficulty of the string instrument is there are no frets on what we play. And it's not like the piano. The note isn't just there. You have to use your ear to guide your finger. So it takes a bit of getting used to it. I'd be brave and go for it.
Tell them to be brave, Brittany, and maybe that can be their guiding star. Wow, this has been fantastic. So here we are all these years in. Have you tempted your brothers or sisters to over to your viola, or they're stuck? They're old violins and cellos.
Yeah, they're happy with what they do.
We're gonna get here to a little more Saltarella before we go out. But this is Italian for jump or leap or something.
That's right. It's an old Italian dance from the 14th century, something to do with jumping around. We thought it suited the album because we jump around from century to century, and I think it was nice to hear these pieces side by side. It opens, puts new light on all of them, I think.
We've got rock players calling in this hour from Minneapolis, Boston, all over. Where do you think the viola goes next, Garth?
Well, it's anybody's guess. As I say, it's an instrument you can be creative on because there's all there's left to do. History hasn't been mapped out. The sounds haven't been used up. I'd invite everyone to pick up their viola, and if they haven't got one, to go out and buy a viola and just be creative and make something new with it.
Well, it looks like plenty of room to do that. We've got music and video of Garth Knox at our website, onpointradio.org. His latest collection, you've heard a lot of it this hour, Saltarello, one track from that behind us right now. Saltarello number 2. Garth Knox, you're very generous and wonderful with your time and your music, and we're so happy you brought the viola and the medieval fiddle and your viola d'amore in for us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks,
from Paris.
Tom. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much, Garth Knox. Listeners, thanks for joining us. We'll go out with just a little more. You can leap, you can dance, you can play the viola. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.